aimed only to sow dissension, the better to rule as king over them all. In that, he was no doubt correct. Octavian would have found a way to initiate a war with Antony, even if Antony had thrown over Cleopatra. Why would anyone associate with a man who unceremoniously disenfranchised a colleague, who illegally seized the will of a friend, companion, kinsman? Octavian was without the courage to declare himself openly, Antony thundered, although he is at war with me and is already acting in every way like one who has not only conquered me, but also murdered me. The experience, the popularity, the numbers were all on Antony's side. He was the skilled commander behind whom stood the most powerful dynasts in Asia. 500 warships, a land army of 19 legions, more than 10,000 cavalry, answered to his orders. It made no difference that he had no authority in Rome. A third of the Senate was at his side. For 12 years, Antony had contended that Octavian plotted to destroy him. Realistically and opportunistically, Cleopatra could only have agreed. The couple were finally right. Antony was equally correct that in a contest of disingenuousness, he could not rival his former brother-in-law. Cleopatra might have, but she was obliged to let Antony do the talking. It was most unfortunate that Antony had made himself a traitor to Rome, clucked Octavian. He was heartsick about the state of affairs. He had felt so affectionately toward him that he had entrusted him with a share in the command and with a much-loved sister. Octavian had not declared war, even after Antony had humiliated that sister, neglected their children, and bestowed upon another woman's children the possessions of the Roman people. Surely Antony would see the light. Octavian had no such hopes for Cleopatra. "For I adjudged her," he scoffed, "if only on account of her foreign birth, to be an enemy by reason of her very conduct." He insisted that Antony would, if not voluntarily, at least reluctantly, change his course as a result of the decrees passed against her. Octavian knew full well that Antony would do no such thing. He and Cleopatra were well beyond that point. Matters of the heart aside, he was the most faithful of men. The situation with Octavian was, moreover, untenable. It would be difficult to say to whom Cleopatra was more vital in 32, the man to whom she was the partner, or the man to whom she was the pretext. Antony could not win a war without her. Octavian could not wage one. Philippi had bought Antony a decade of goodwill. It abruptly came to an end now. In the fall, he and Cleopatra moved west to Patras, an undistinguished town at the entrance of the Gulf of Corinth. From that point, they established a defensive line up and down the west coast of Greece, distributing men from Actium in the north to Mitanni in the south. The intention seems to have been to protect the supply lines to Alexandria, along with Egypt itself, on which Octavian had, after all, declared war. Cleopatra profited from the pause to issue coins, on which she appears as Isis. Antony sent considerable quantities of gold back to Rome, distributing bribes left and right. He had the greater force, but labored all the same to undermine the loyalty of Octavian's men. The bulk of those funds were presumably Cleopatra's. Octavian's war levies, meanwhile, set off riots in Rome. Also back and forth over the winter went various spies and senators, their loyalties fragile and mercurial. Many had faced this quandary at least once before. Whom to flee and whom to follow? It was a test of personalities rather than principles. Elsewhere, it seemed as if a magnet had passed over the Mediterranean world, drawing the skittering sides into a taut alignment that, as a whole, far surpassed in size anything that had ever been before. The sovereigns Antony had installed in 36 turned out in full force. Among others, The Libyan, Thracian, Pontic, and Cappadocian kings joined him with their fleets. The winter passed in a fever pitch of inertia. For the second time, the usually rash Antony appeared slow to open a campaign, one for which Cleopatra could only have been impatient. With every month, she was running up considerable expenses. The rule of thumb was 40 to 50 talents per legion per year, which put Cleopatra's summer outlay for the infantry alone in the vicinity of 210 talents. It was difficult to escape the impression that Antony, the most famous soldier alive, had no desire for an epic battle. Of an earlier occasion, it would be said of Caesar that he sought a reputation rather than a province, an assertion that was arguably more true of his protege. Octavian invited Antony to an absurd staged encounter. Antony challenged Octavian to a duel. Neither materialized. Mostly the two sides confined themselves to insults and idle threats, to spying upon and annoying each other. The air pulsed with rumor, much of it generated by Octavian. In 33, he expelled the multitude of astrologers and soothsayers from Rome, ostensibly to purge the growing Eastern influence, actually better to control the storyline. In their absence, it was easier to elicit the kinds of omens Octavian preferred. He wanted to be the only one in the prophecy business. So it was that Antony and Cleopatra's statues in the Acropolis were said to have been struck by lightning and to lie in sorry ruins. 85-foot-long, two-headed serpents appeared. A marble statue of Antony oozed blood. When the children of Rome divided themselves into Antonians and Octavians for a fierce, two-day-long street battle, the miniature Octavians prevailed. The truth was closer to that suggested by two talking ravens. Their equitable trainer had taught the first to squawk, "Hail Caesar, our victorious commander." The other learned, "Hail Antony, our victorious commander." A smart Roman had every reason to hedge his bets and to believe that with their hot-headed rhetoric, their personal agendas, Antony and Octavian were perfectly interchangeable. Even those on intimate terms with both conceded that each desired to be the ruler not only of the city of Rome, but of the whole world. While the funds and experience were largely on Antony and Cleopatra's side, so too were the ambiguities, beginning with the matter, not necessarily more transparent in 32 than it is today, of their marriage. As a foreigner, Cleopatra could not, under Roman law, become Antony's wife, even after his divorce. Only by the more supple, accommodating logic of the Greek East could the two have been said to have married. From the Egyptian point of view, the question was irrelevant. Cleopatra had no need to be married to Antony, who was without any official status in Egypt, which she ruled with Caesarion. Antony was there a queen's consort and patron, not a king. That was unproblematic in Egypt. It was a model to Rome. Was Cleopatra meant to play a role in the West? Again, there was no category for her, or rather there was. If she was not a wife, she was, by definition, a concubine. In which case, why did Antony stamp her image on Roman coins? Antony and Cleopatra's joint intentions, too, were murky. Did they mean to realize the dream of Alexander the Great? To unite men across national boundaries and under one divine law, as the prophecy had it? Or did Antony intend to set himself up as an Oriental monarch, with Cleopatra as empress? He made it easy for Octavian. A Roman surrendered his citizenship if he formally attached himself to another state. Their agenda may have been better defined. Probably they meant to establish two capitals. But generally, they taxed the category-loving Roman mind. and they turned the client-king arrangement on its head. A foreigner was meant to be subservient, not equal to a Roman. As such, it was easy for Octavian to make a case for the transgressive, insatiable woman intent on conquest. He did so convincingly and enduringly. One of the greatest 20th-century classicists has Cleopatra working through Antony like a parasite to realize ambitions she may never have considered. The military intentions were opaque as well. For what precisely was Antony fighting? He might well mean to restore the Republic as he claimed, but what then to make of the mother of his three half-Roman children? For Octavian, by contrast, all was crystalline and categorical, or at least it was, once he had passed off a personal vendetta as a foreign war. His argument had cleaner lines and better visuals. He made a splendid, splashy appeal to xenophobia. Surely his men, we who are Romans and lords of the greatest and best portion of the world, were not going to be rattled by these primitives. Not for the last time, the world divided into a masculine, rational West and a feminine, indefinite East, on which Octavian declared a sort of crusade. He fought against something, but for something as well. For Roman probity, piety, and self-control, precisely those qualities his former brother-in-law had shrugged off in his embrace of Cleopatra. Antony was no longer a Roman, but an Egyptian. A mere cymbal player, effeminate, inconsequential, and impotent. For it is impossible for one who leads a life of royal luxury and coddles himself like a woman to have a manly thought or do a manly deed. Footnote. Nicolaus of Damascus was quick to assert that even as a teenager, even at the age when youth are most wanton, Octavian had abstained from sexual gratification for an entire year. And in the face of all evidence to the contrary, it was inevitably asserted that he lived simply and austerely. In truth, Octavian was as fond of costly furniture and Corinthian bronzes as the next man, more fond yet of the gaming table. End of footnote. Octavian savaged even Antony's literary style. And incidentally, had anyone noticed that Antony drank? Octavian stressed his role as Caesar's heir less often. Instead, he went in for tales of his own divinity, which he broadcast widely. Few in Rome failed to hear of his descent from Apollo, to whom he was dedicating a fine new temple. In reducing Antony to a cymbal player, Octavian accomplished an especially difficult feat. He publicly acknowledged what many men who have faced a woman across a tennis net have since noted. In such a contest, there is greater pride to be lost than glory to be gained. By the Roman definition, a woman hardly qualified as a worthy opponent. Coaxing a tinny accusation into a series of resonant chords, later scored for a full orchestra, Octavian rhapsodized about Cleopatra. He endowed her with every kind of power to create an enduring grotesque. This brutal, bloodthirsty Egyptian queen was no latter-day Fulvia. She was a vicious enemy, with designs on all Roman possessions. Surely the great and glorious people who had subdued the Germans, trampled the Gauls, and invaded the Britons, who had conquered Hannibal and burned Carthage, were not going to tremble before this pestilence of a woman. What would their glorious forefathers say if they learned that a people of singular exploits and vast conquests, to whom every region of the world had now submitted, had been trodden underfoot by an Egyptian harlot, her eunuchs, and her hairdressers? Indeed, they faced a formidable array of forces, Octavian assured his men. But to win great prizes, one waged great contests. In this one, the honor of Rome was at stake. It was the obligation of those destined to conquer and rule all mankind to uphold their illustrious history, to avenge those who insulted them, and to allow no woman to make herself equal to a man. Footnote. As the poet Propertius asked later, what does our history mean if it leads to the rule of a woman? End of footnote. Early in 31, Octavian's superb admiral, Agrippa, made a swift surprise crossing to Greece. A longtime friend and mentor to Octavian, he supplied the military acumen his commander lacked. Agrippa disrupted Antony's supply lines and captured his southern base. In his wake, Octavian transferred 80,000 men from the Adriatic coast across the Ionian Sea. The move forced Antony north. His infantry was not yet in place. He was wholly taken aback. Cleopatra attempted to calm him by making light of the enemy's sudden presence in a fine natural port, it was probably modern Parga, on a spoon-shaped promontory. What is there dreadful in Caesar's sitting at a ladle? She scoffed. Straight away, Octavian offered battle, which Antony could not yet manage. His crews were incomplete. By an early morning feint, he forced Octavian to withdraw. Weeks of taunts and skirmishes followed, as Octavian roamed freely among the harbors of western Greece, and as Antony settled his legions on a sandy spit of land at the southern entrance to the Ambracian Gulf. Actium offered an excellent harbor, if in a damp, desolate area. Antony and Cleopatra could not have been long in realizing that the swampy lowland, thick with ferns and grasses, was infinitely more suitable as a battle site than as a campsite. The weeks passed in attempted engagements and attenuated decisions. Octavian could not lure Antony out to sea. Antony could not coax Octavian out on land. He remained more intent on cutting Antony's supply lines, at which over the spring and early summer he proved highly proficient. Cleopatra may have affected perfect insouciance about his landing, but the truth was that in the wake of a series of inexplicable slow-motion decisions, they may not have made sense even before Octavian's eulogists got hold of them. Antony and Cleopatra began to cede the advantage. Meanwhile, the question of strategy hung heavily over Antony's head. To meet Octavian on land or at sea? For the most part, the two armies glared at each other across the narrow strait, from one grassy promontory to the other. From the distance, Antony's camp must have offered a splendid sight, with its vast and variegated armies, the flashes of gold-spangled purple-red robes. Towering Thracians in black tunics and bright armor mingled with Macedonians in fresh scarlet cloaks, Medians in richly colored vests. A Ptolemaic military cloak, woven with gold, might feature a royal portrait or a mythological scene. The scruffy Greek lowland blazed with costly equipment, with gleaming helmets and gilded breastplates, jeweled bridles, dyed plumes, decorated spears. Footnote. In this realm alone, ostentation met with Roman approval. As Plutarch explains, for extravagance in other objects of display induces luxury and implants effeminacy in those who use them, since something like a pricking and tickling of the senses breaks down serious purpose. But when it is seen in the trappings of war, it strengthens and exalts the spirit. End of footnote. The bulk of the soldiers were Eastern, as were an increasing number of rowers, many of them raw recruits. With them assembled an ecumenical collection of arms. Thracian wicker shields and quivers joined Roman javelins and Cretan bows and long Macedonian pikes. Cleopatra footed much of the bill, but contributed something else, too. Unlike Antony, she could communicate with the assembled dignitaries of the East. She spoke the language of the Armenian cavalry, the Ethiopian infantry, the Median detachments, as well as that of royalty. There was a code of behavior among Hellenistic sovereigns. Most had experience of powerful queens, and Canidius had not misspoken. By her presence, Cleopatra reminded her fellow dynasts that they were battling for something other than a Roman Republic, in which they had no interest. They had little sympathy for either Antony or Octavian, against either of whom they might just as easily have aligned, as they had aligned against Rome in 89 with Mithridates. Had she not launched herself directly into the heart of Roman affairs with her call on Caesar in 48, Cleopatra would have been in precisely their position. She and Antony turned away only one sovereign, naturally the most enthusiastic of the bunch. Herod arrived with money, a well-trained army, equipment, and a shipment of grain. He delivered as well some familiar advice. Were Antony only to murder Cleopatra and annex Egypt, his troubles would be over. Herod's army and provisions remained, but his stay in camp was brief. For his priceless counsel, he was packed off to fight Malchus, the Nabatean king, said to be delinquent with his bitumen payments. Simultaneously, Cleopatra ordered her general in that stony region to frustrate both monarchs' efforts. She preferred that they destroy each other. Closer up, all was not quite so rosy. The wait in a vast multi-ethnic military camp under less than salubrious conditions took its toll. As the temperature rose, conditions deteriorated. Cleopatra's presence did little for morale. No doubt accurately, Herod wrote his dismissal down to her. That she occupied a vital position in camp and did little to apologize for that position is clear. As Egypt's commander-in-chief, she believed war preparations and operations to be her duty. She seems to have assumed that Antony was the only friend she needed. She was unwilling to be silenced, ironic given how little of her voice survives. There would be none of Queen Isabella of Spain's deferential, "May your lordship pardon me for speaking of things which I do not understand." It is impossible to say what came first, the Roman humiliation at Cleopatra's presence or Cleopatra's superciliousness with the Romans. Antony's officers were said to be ashamed of her and of her status as equal partner. His closest companions objected to her authority. She had backed herself into a corner. To relax her guard was to be sent home. To maintain it was to offend. She may have been rattled, too. There were stormy scenes with Antony. Cleopatra failed in particular to endear herself to Gnaeus Domitius Ahenobarbus, arguably Antony's most distinguished supporter. A proud republican, Ahenobarbus had led the consuls who had fled to Ephesus the previous spring. He was resolute and incorruptible. From the start, he and Cleopatra had trouble. He refused to address her by her title. To him, she remained simply Cleopatra. She attempted to buy him off, only to discover that Ahenobarbus was as straight-spined as Plancus was invertebrate. True to his reputation, Ahenobarbus was vocal, too. He made no secret of his opinion that she was a liability, and he believed a war could be avoided. Implicated in and condemned for Caesar's murder, later proscribed, Ahenobarbus had fought at Philippi against Antony. The two reconciled afterward, since which time Ahenobarbus had occupied every high office and counted among Antony's most devoted adherents. He had been instrumental in opposing Octavian. He had fought to suppress the damaging news of the donations. Already Ahenobarbus's son was promised to one of Antony's daughters. Together, the two men had survived all kinds of adversity. They'd been through Parthia together, where Ahenobarbus proved himself stalwart and a leader. When Antony had been too despondent to do so himself, Ahenobarbus had addressed the troops on their commander's behalf. As morale deteriorated in Actium, the senior statesman this time took a different route. In a small boat, he defected to Octavian. Antony was devastated. True to form, He sent his former colleagues, baggage, friends, and servants to join him. Cleopatra disapproved of his magnanimity. She could not have been unaware of the discomfort her presence caused in the sweltering, mosquito-infested camp, where her retinue and tents made for a discordant sight, and where her immense flagship, the Antonia, with its 10 banks of oars and carved and decorated bow, presumably evoked little pride. Rations were curtailed. The men were hungry, the mood sour. Cleopatra sat on a pile of closely guarded treasure. A Roman soldier liked to see his general eating stale bread and sleeping on a simple pallet. Cleopatra disturbed that equation. From all sides, Antony, his tent positioned squarely at the center of the vast camp, heard that Cleopatra should be sent away, to which pleas he remained deaf. Even the trusted Canidius, who had earlier argued on her behalf, wanted her gone. She knew of the ridicule Fulvia had inspired. Even in Egypt, female commanders were not popular, as Cleopatra understood from her sister's short career during the Alexandrian War. She had no experience of armed conflict on this scale. Herod's theory was that Antony would not send her away, as his ears, it seems, were stopped by his infatuation. Why, then, did she not step aside, as she had with Caesar? Octavian had declared war on her alone. She had every reason to demand vengeance. She had been shunted aside by military advisors before, to wind up in the Sinai Desert, homeless and disenfranchised. She had been ill-served by intermediaries. She may well have been unwilling to entrust Egypt's fate to Antony alone. All was at stake. The future of the Ptolemaic dynasty hung in the balance. Were Octavian and Antony to come to terms now, she would be the price of that accord. The real mystery of 31 is less why Cleopatra remained than why, having expertly neutralized cultural collisions in Egypt, having artfully assuaged Roman egos, she neglected to work her charm on Antony's officers. In camp, she seems to have been an infuriating and exhausting presence. Many were treated to the scorn she had heaped on the straight-talking Geminius. Friends of Antony and Roman consuls alike suffered at her hands, universally reported to have been abused by Cleopatra. She was vindictive, peremptory, brittle. Experience had not made her any more tractable than she had been as a teenager with her brother's advisors. She was, after all, accustomed to exercising supreme authority, poor at taking orders. Meanwhile, morale plunged as Octavian's blockade tightened around the Gulf, as swarms of mosquitoes descended upon the camp, and as an epidemic, it was likely malaria, set in. Conditions were deplorable. Relief came only toward midday, when with a rustle, the wind picked up from the west. For a few hours, a fresh, brisk breeze swept in, growing stronger as it pivoted from west to north, to subside as the sun set. Months passed in readiness and inactivity, and with them, a gradual reordering of the odds. While the idea had presumably been to trap Octavian in the Ambracian Gulf, Antony and Cleopatra found themselves bottled up in the bright blue bay, a shifting of realities to which they were slow to adjust. Notes Plutarch. The chief task of a good general is to force his enemies to give battle when he is superior to them, but not to be forced himself to do this when his forces are inferior. Antony had long relinquished that advantage. By August, he had no choice but to enlist whole towns to carry supplies overland to camp. Plutarch's great-grandfather was among those miserably pressed into service to make the trek over mountain paths to the Gulf, sacks of wheat on their shoulders, whips at their backs. What the blockade, the disease, The debilitating inactivity the heat did not affect. The desertions did. Slaves and client kings alike abandoned the cause. Antony made an example of two near deserters, a senator and a Syrian king, tortured and executed to discourage imitators. Antony was himself rattled, enough so to attempt a solitary stroll along the fortifications toward the sea, in the course of which Octavian's men nearly succeeded in kidnapping him. Ahenobarbus's defection affected him deeply. He was afterward fiercely paranoid. By one account, he distrusted even Cleopatra, whom he suspected of attempting to poison him. To prove her innocence, she was said to have prepared a lethal drink, only to intercept the goblet as Antony raised it to his lips. Had she intended to kill him, she would not have done so, would she? She then sent for a prisoner, to whom she handed the potion. It had the advertised effect. The story is suspect, as Cleopatra could hardly proceed without Antony. He was unlikely to have forgotten as much, even in an agitated state. Cleopatra quarreled as well with Delius, who had spent his summer recruiting mercenaries. The two came to blows at dinner one night, when Delius complained of the wine. It was sour, he scoffed, while in Rome, Octavian's staff downed the finest vintages. Delius emerged from the tussle, convinced that Cleopatra meant to murder him. One of her physicians, he claimed, confirmed as much. It was a perfectly legitimate excuse for his third and final defection. He fled to Octavian, depriving Antony of what Caesar had termed the mightiest of weapons. Surprise. With Delius went Antony's battle plans. Toward the end of August, Antony called a war council. 16 weeks of blockade had taken a toll. The situation was bleak. Supplies were short. The night air was crisp. Winter would soon be upon them. Antony needed finally to resolve the question that had plagued him through the scorching summer. Tactics came more easily to him than did strategy. He could be indecisive. If she had not already done so, Cleopatra now fell out, even with Canidius. He preferred to march north and to decide the contest on land. They were Romans, after all. To wage battle atop scudding waves was, in his opinion, folly. Antony had never before commanded a fleet. He could yield the sea to Octavian without shame. There were, moreover, recruits to be had in Macedonia and Thrace. Of course, Canidius knew well that to fight on land was to sacrifice Cleopatra's fleet and with it her usefulness. Cleopatra knew that to sacrifice the fleet was to imperil Egypt. Her chests of silver denarii could not be carted across mountains. She argued vigorously for a naval engagement. Her reasons were perfectly sound. Antony was seriously outnumbered on land. He could not ultimately cross to Italy without a fleet. Nor was it easy to move an army over mountains. 5 years had not erased the memory of Parthia. There was another consideration as well, an analog that no one involved in the Actium deliberations could have ignored. For his showdown with Caesar, Pompey, too, had marshaled a massive, noisy, polyglot force of Asiatic kings and princes in Greece. Cleopatra had contributed 60 ships to that fleet. Ahenobarbus had been present, as had his father, who had perished in the battle. Antony had commanded with distinction on the opposite side. In August 48, Pompey had elected to ignore his navy, far superior to Caesar's. Hardly was the day out when he realized that he had blundered grievously in opting for a land battle. The result was utter carnage, a speechless, senseless commander, robbed of his army, his wits, and his pride, and days later, decapitated off the coast of Egypt. Antony opted for a naval campaign. Plutarch has him swayed by emotion. More likely, the most experienced general of his day meant neither to accommodate Cleopatra nor to showcase her navy, but bowed in the end to necessity. Octavian had not only a more coherent narrative, but a more cohesive force, an army of Latin-speaking, well-drilled Romans. The land advantage was his. At sea, the two sides were more evenly matched. Antony explained as much to his restless men, few of whom could swim. He did not care to open a campaign with a defeat. "I have chosen to begin with the ships, where we are strongest and have a vast superiority over our antagonists, in order that after a victory with these, we may scorn their infantry also." Elaborating on the same theme, Octavian proved himself more psychologically astute. For in general, it is a natural characteristic of human nature everywhere that whenever a man fails in his first contests, he becomes disheartened with respect to what is to come. Despite the explanations, a battle-worn veteran threw himself upon Antony with an emotional appeal. He displayed an astonishing collection of scars. How could Antony insult those wounds, to invest his hopes in miserable logs of wood? The soldier pleaded with his commander, "Let Egyptians and Phoenicians do their fighting at sea, but give us land on which we are accustomed to stand and either conquer our enemies or die." Antony, better endowed by nature than any man of his time for leading an army by force of eloquence, looked upon him kindly, but could not manage a reply. Over the last days of August, a familiar smell greeted Cleopatra. The afternoon breeze lifted the acrid odor of flaming cedar and resin throughout the camp. It was a smell she knew from the Alexandrian harbor 17 years earlier. In what must have seemed to be a regular Roman tradition, Antony dragged some 80 of her ships to the beach and set fire to them. He no longer had the crew to man the fleet and could not risk its falling into Octavian's hands. That was no secret. The blaze was bright and pungent. A storm soon extinguished the lingering wisps of smoke. For 4 days, gale winds and drenching rains lashed the coast. By the time the weather cleared, only warped fittings and scorched rams remained. Under cover of darkness on the evening of September 1st, Cleopatra's officers secretly loaded her chests of treasure onto the massive Antonia. Several transport ships took on additional monies, as well as a hoard of royal tableware. Masts and bulky sails went aboard both Cleopatra's ships and Antony's. By sunrise, Antony had embarked 20,000 soldiers, and with them thousands of archers and slingers, wedging a colossal number of men into slivers of space. The sky was crystal clear, and the sea a glassy sheet as they rowed out, with a crash and clatter of oars, to the mouth of the gulf. There Antony's three squadrons stationed themselves in close crescent formation. Cleopatra and her remaining 60 ships took up the rear, as much to head off deserters as for protection. She was not meant to take part in the fighting. Outside the strait, Antony's men discovered Octavian's fleet assembled in a similar formation about a mile off. The gulf resounded with the high-pitched blasts of trumpets. Criers and officers urged the men on. And Antony's 240 ships, oars poised, prows pointed, facing Octavian's 400, sat through the morning, prepared to fight, hulls crammed together, creaking and motionless, as the land armies watched from shore. Finally, at midday, Octavian ordered his northernmost squadron to row backward in an attempt to draw Antony out. His ships advanced into open water. Instantly, the air was thick with shouts. on shore and on the water. From the lofty towers of Antony's fleet, a dense hail of stones and arrows and metal shards rained down. On Octavian's side, oars shattered and rudders snapped. Despite the sea churning beneath her, it was from Cleopatra's perspective an odd floating land battle, with Octavian's men playing the cavalry and Antony's men repelling the assault from their floating fortresses, the largest of which loomed 10 feet above the waterline. The fierce ramming and grappling continued inconclusively until late in the afternoon. At about 3 o'clock, Octavian's left wing shifted to outflank Antony's. Antony's, in turn, edged north. The center of the line dissolved. Suddenly, Cleopatra's squadron hoisted sail and, expertly plying the wind, broke coolly through the middle of the battle, past the flying slings and missiles, beyond the spears and axes of the enemy line, sowing confusion on all sides. Octavian's men looked on in amazement as Cleopatra sped south in her majestic flagship, its purple sails billowing. For the most part, the enemy was powerless to overtake her. Their shock only increased when, moments later, Antony transferred from his flagship to a swift galley and followed behind with 40 ships of his personal squadron. Octavian's men were arguably less bewildered, as Plutarch has it, than impressed. Antony and Cleopatra had slipped away with a third of the remaining fleet and all of her treasure. Clearly the flight had been prearranged. There would have been neither valuables nor sails stowed on Cleopatra's ships otherwise. She timed her move perfectly to take advantage of the brisk and favorable rise in the wind. And from Delius, Octavian had known of the blockade-breaking plan. Antony and Cleopatra had had no intention of prolonging a battle. Earlier in the month, they had already once attempted to force their way through the blockade. If they could nudge Octavian out to sea, they could escape to Egypt. They made this sally only in order to do so. In the pre-battle speech Dio supplies him, Octavian alerts his men to precisely this course of events. Since, then, they admit that they are weaker than we are, and since they carry the prizes of victory in their ships, let us not allow them to sail anywhere else, but let us conquer them here on the spot and take all these treasures away from them. On September 2nd, a few of Octavian's swift ships, light, highly maneuverable galleys with streamlined prows, indeed headed off in pursuit. On the high seas, Cleopatra signaled to Antony. With 2 companions, he climbed over the whitecaps to board the Antonia. The reunion was not a happy one. Antony neither saw nor spoke to Cleopatra on account of what sounds more like shame than anger. Something had gone very wrong. Probably Antony's men were not meant to have remained behind. Cleopatra had earlier argued that the bulk of the army return with her to Egypt. The fleet had either been unable to escape or had elected not to do so. They may have preferred to fight a Roman rather than follow a foreigner. Certainly there were mutinous murmurs in camp. Antony and Cleopatra may have planned the maneuver only in case of necessity, and alone or together acted peremptorily. Or Cleopatra may have made her exit prematurely. She must have been longing to sail off to Alexandria, a city that, were she vanquished off the coast of Greece, she knew she would never see again. Dio suggests that Antony fled because he erroneously read a concession of defeat in Cleopatra's departure. Or all went precisely according to plan, and its repercussions emerged only after the fact. We are left to square unintelligible decisions with obscure accounts. In any event, Antony could not have bowed his head in defeat, as the engagement, less a skirmish than a melee, continued inconclusively for some time. Even Octavian would not know by day's end who had prevailed. Whether the plan had been misconceived or had miscarried, the I told you so's hang palpably in the salty breeze. If Plutarch can be believed, Antony choked on his helplessness. Ignoring Cleopatra, he went forward alone to the prow and sat down by himself in silence, holding his head in both hands. He stirred only at dusk when two of Octavian's galleys materialized in the distance. Antony commanded the flagship to be swung around so that he might stand and face the enemy head on. A skirmish ensued, from which the Antonia escaped, but to which Cleopatra sacrificed a command ship and a second vessel, packed with a quantity of rich plate and furniture. Having fended off the assailants, Antony returned to the prow. Head bowed, he stared listlessly out to sea. The hero of Philippi, the new Dionysus, reduced to a great brooding hulk, the powerful arms and shoulders startlingly still. The cruise south was a bitter one, infected by mutual anxieties and private losses. It was also quiet. Antony spent 3 days alone, either in anger with Cleopatra or wishing not to upbraid her. While it may have been forged of desperation, the plan had at one time seemed a sensible one. Antony could not now escape the impression that he had deserted his men. They had remained steadfast while kings, senators, officers had abandoned him. He had left them in the lurch to find himself in an untenable position with Cleopatra. The outcome of the Battle of Actium remained unclear, as it would for several days, but he understood the implications of what he had done and how it appeared. A Roman commander was meant to stare down defeat, to persist regardless of all debilitating odds. And history was entirely palpable to Mark Antony. In Rome he lived grandly, in a house decorated by 90 bronze rams captured at sea. They were Pompey's. He understood what glory had just slipped, forever, through his fingers. After 3 days, Cleopatra put in for water and supplies at Tanarum, the southernmost point of the Peloponnesian Peninsula. Fittingly, it was the cape where Hercules was believed to have searched for the entrance to the underworld. There, two of her servants, Iris the hairdresser and Carmion the lady-in-waiting, urged a reconciliation. With some coaxing, the two women persuaded Antony and Cleopatra to speak, eventually even to eat and sleep together. Several transport ships joined them, with news of what had transpired after their Actium departure. The battle had intensified and continued on for hours. Antony's fleet had held out, but was ultimately destroyed. For some time, the surf delivered up bodies and timber, flecked, if a particularly colorful account can be believed, with the purple and gold spangles of the east. Antony's land forces held firm. At the end of the meeting, Antony attempted to distribute gifts to his men. From one of the transport ships, he handed around gold and silver treasures from Cleopatra's palace. In tears, his men refused the prizes. Their commander showered them instead with affection. He would, he promised, arrange for them to be hidden away safely until they could agree on terms with Octavian. With Cleopatra, he continued on across the Mediterranean to the flat coast of Egypt. They made landfall in a desolate outpost in the northwestern corner of the country, where they separated along the expanse of sandy beach. Antony headed to Libya, where he had posted 4 legions. He planned to regroup. Cleopatra, her fleet lost, her treasure partly dispersed, her ally ruined, hurried to Alexandria. She had left Actium before anyone else, and in a powerful, well-equipped ship. If she moved rapidly, she could outsail news of the fiasco. She knew what it was to return to Egypt under catastrophic conditions and took precautions. She ordered some quick floral arranging. When she glided past the lighthouse of Alexandria the following day, she did so serenely, her ships garlanded with wreaths of flowers. Accompanied by flute players, an on-deck chorus chanted victory songs. To those who rowed out to meet her, Cleopatra imparted the news of her extraordinary triumph, presumably without a trace of dryness in her throat. Nearly simultaneously, Antony's 19 legions and 12,000 cavalry, having finally given up hope that their commander would return to them, and after a week of stubborn negotiation, surrendered to Octavian, who was only just beginning to grasp the scale of his victory. Chapter 9. The Wickedest Woman in History. I was equal to gods, except for the mortal part. Euripides. Misfortune, went the saying, has few friends. Cleopatra did not wait to discover if the adage was true. If her ruse had not already been discovered, it was confirmed quickly enough now, in blood. The Alexandrian elite had disapproved of her before. She feared their reaction on learning of the Axium debacle. They could now fairly accuse her of having delivered Egypt to Rome. She did not care to watch them exult in her defeat, nor did she care to be replaced on the throne. She no sooner returned than she embarked on an unbridled killing spree, ordering her most prominent detractors arrested and assassinated. From their estates, she confiscated great sums. She appropriated additional monies wherever she could find them, seizing temple treasures. For whatever came next, a fortune was required. It would be expensive to buy off the inevitable. In one form or another, Octavian would come calling. She equipped new forces and cast about for allies, whom she courted baldly. Artavastes, the defiant Armenian king, had remained a prisoner in Alexandria, where his 3 years of captivity now came to an end. Cleopatra sent his severed head some 1,200 miles east to his Median rival. She calculated that he would need no further encouragement to rise to her assistance. He demurred. As in the past, she reached out to the east, where she had trade contacts and longtime partisans, where Octavian was without traction, and where royalty was royalty. When Antony returned to Alexandria, he found her consumed by a most bold and wonderful enterprise. An isthmus separated the Mediterranean from the Gulf of Suez at the eastern frontier of Egypt. With a large force, Cleopatra attempted to lift her ships out of the Mediterranean and haul them 40 miles overland to be relaunched via the Gulf into the Red Sea. With her men and money, she proposed to make a new home for herself, well beyond the borders of Egypt, possibly even in India, far away from war and slavery. In a blind alley, it seemed Cleopatra's nature to envision broad, unbounded horizons. The grandiosity and bravado were staggering, practically enough to suggest that she truly had contemplated an assault on the Roman world. Cleopatra's Red Sea venture was not impossible in a country that had for centuries hauled immense stone blocks across vast distances. A monstrosity of a too-proud Ptolemaic vessel, it was said to have been nearly 400 feet long and to sit 60 feet above the water, had centuries earlier been launched along wooden rollers, set at even intervals along a harborside ditch. Greased hides occasionally served the same purpose. Ships could be broken as well into sections. The enterprise was less feasible for a sovereign who had antagonized the tribe on the far side of the isthmus. Those happened to be the Nabateans, the shrewd, well-organized traders who had spent a year fighting Herod, thanks in part to Cleopatra's sabotage. They did not need Herod, who had finally just defeated them, to remind them that Cleopatra was their common enemy. The Nabateans set fire to each of the Egyptian ships as it was drawn ashore. For Cleopatra, the failure was particularly bitter. This was the corner of the world from which she had successfully relaunched herself in 48. Herod was, of course, the obvious ally. In the desert, Octavian would be no match for their combined forces. To no one, however, was Cleopatra's misfortune so profoundly satisfying. Cleopatra had dealt Herod a get-out-of-jail-free card in dismissing him from Actium. He lost no time in making his peace with Octavian. Probably in Rhodes that fall, the Judean king made a great show of contrition. Dressed as a commoner, he removed his diadem as he set foot on shore. Before the new master of the Roman world, he was frank and forthright. Indeed, he had been loyal to Antony. Such, alas, was his nature. Integrity was his stock in trade. In his book, explained Herod, a friend ought to risk every bit of his soul and body and substance. Had he not been off assailing the Nabateans, he would, he assured Octavian, be at Antony's side even at that very moment. He abandoned his good friend of over two decades, now only on account of that Egyptian woman, he admitted, proceeding to cough up the official version of Octavian's war on Cleopatra. He had told Antony to do away with her. There is no indication of how Herod got through this speech with a straight face. At its end, Octavian professed himself grateful to Cleopatra. She had, he reassured his caller, bequeathed him a fine ally. Herod had reason to be doubly grateful to Cleopatra. He owed his crown to Roman fears of her in the first place. Graciously, Octavian replaced the diadem on Herod's head. He sent him off with Roman reinforcements. Meanwhile, Cleopatra continued tirelessly to court neighboring tribes and friendly kings. She was able to mobilize only a troop of gladiators, highly skilled fighters who had been training for what were presumed to be Antony and Cleopatra's victory celebrations. Answering her call, they headed south from what is today modern Turkey. Herod saw to it that they got no farther than Syria. Failing the east, Cleopatra could look in the opposite direction. Rome had not fully conquered Spain, a restive region hugely fertile and rich in silver mines. Even if the Mediterranean were closed to her, even if she were unable to continue the war against Octavian, she might sail west via the Indian Ocean, circumnavigating Africa. With her vast resources, she and Antony might stir up Spain's native tribes and found a new kingdom. It was not such a far-fetched idea. Cleopatra had before her the example of another linguistically gifted, charismatic leader. In 83, a rogue Roman proconsul had seized control of Spain, to the horror of his countrymen. Hailed by his native recruits as the new Hannibal, Sertorius had incited a revolt. He had very nearly gone on to establish an independent Roman state. Footnote. Nor was Cleopatra the first savvy Easterner to team up with a Roman general. Sertorius had joined forces with Mithridates, the Pontic king, who in 69 so eloquently warned of Rome's rise. Mithridates, too, had envisioned precisely the sort of amalgamated empire Cleopatra and Antony represented. He put decades towards its realization, to be vanquished by Pompey. Pompey ultimately defeated Sertorius as well, after a victorious 4-year campaign. End of footnote. Cleopatra considered the prospect seriously. Octavian worried that she would manage to repeat Sertorius's coup. A military operation at home was, after all, unlikely. With the defections of Herod and of Antony's Cyrenian troops, Egypt was all that remained. It was firmly behind Cleopatra. In Upper Egypt, her partisans offered to rise up on her behalf, an effort she discouraged, but unlikely to hold out long against Octavian. She had, at best, 400 fiercely loyal Gaulish bodyguards, a modest number of troops, and a remnant of a fleet. Nothing about the Battle of Actium had been as brilliant as the blaze of invective that preceded it. Most of the drama, and many of the casualties, came after the unspectacular fact. It was anticlimactic in the extreme, which could not be said of the months that followed in Alexandria. Yet again, Cleopatra's plans had miscarried.